So, lecture 25, November 15th, lecture notes, page 220, Principles of Marketing. 195 people played with the researcher. Thank you. The researcher thanks you on research extra credit number one. That 0.5% has been posted to your grades. Has people seen it? You know it's out there? Yeah. If you think you did it and didn't get credit for it, contact the researcher or let me know. But I didn't do anything. I just reported it. So, here we are. November 15th, Thanksgiving next week. We do have classes here at Kent Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and beyond are off. Mini test 12 closes this Sunday on its usual schedule. Enhanced Learning Extra Credit and Packback number 9 close tonight on its regular schedule. And 10, I guess, opens tomorrow. And it looks like I keep it open for a long time. So it looks like I keep it open until the Wednesday after Thanksgiving. So we've commented on how well you're doing by adding points there. Gen Z, who's Gen Z here? I'm very disappointed in you. I tell you, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. And yet here you are in this report. I'm embarrassed. Counterfeit merch is a curse for luxury brands. Gen Z thinks that's fine. Approximately 50.7% of Gen Z consumers who wield substantial spending power of $360 billion are indifferent or not concerned about purchasing counterfeit merchandise. Really, peeps? So this is us as business understanding consumer. And the question, we talk about business ethics all the time. How about something about consumer ethics, eh? Among Gen Z shoppers aged 15 to 24, 52 reported buying a counterfeit product online in the past year, with 37% of those who bought one saying they did it on purpose. They knew what they were doing. So again, understanding consumer attitudes and behaviors. Nearly 73% of Gen Z respondents expressed satisfaction with the counterfeit products they own, indicating a shift in attitude towards the cachet of genuine luxury items. This has impact on brands, obviously. Influencers showcasing high-end brands on platforms like Instagram can create a sense of FOMO, fear of missing out, among Gen Z, driving them to opt for more affordable counterfeit alternatives. So negative impact of social media and influencers on Gen Z. Not related to this, sometimes I just wander off into other territory. Have you guys heard about this major lawsuit? I think 47 states, it doesn't matter, are suing Meta over Instagram. Is anybody following that thing? And they're suing them because they're saying that Instagram is so terrible, Meta knows that it's addictive for people, that they just, you know, watch it and watch it and watch it, won't stop watching. So obviously a negative influence, which may or may not be legal, found to be illegal from that. But we're seeing now another negative influence from social media, making it okay to feel good about counterfeit products. Advances in counterfeit production quality make it difficult for consumers to distinguish fake items from genuines, contributing to the acceptance and the demand for counterfeit goods. So normally I like to think about technology in a positive way. Here it's helping counterfeit products be more acceptable. Luxury brands contribute to the popularity of counterfeits by setting retail prices that many G consumers find unaffordable. But they're luxury products. They are supposed to be unaffordable to the average person. That's their cachet. That is their appeal. I guess not. The trend is seen as an act of defiance against perceived high costs. So here's a relationship between price, demand, image, and an unplanned consequence of all this. I don't care, it's too high, I'll just buy a knockoff instead. Screw you. With Gen Z expected to become the largest consumer group, luxury brands face the challenge of dissuading consumers from viewing counterfeits as equivalent to authentic brands. Brands may need to reevaluate pricing structures and focus on, for example, creating unique in-store experiences to differentiate them from the online counterfeit purchases. They're not the same, you can't get this stuff. So, arguably responding to the problem. The next two stories are in the exciting world of supply chain management and logistics. I know you're going to be excited by this stuff, but it's what we're talking about right now. Amazon is introducing warehouse overhaul with robotics to speed deliveries. Amazon.com is introducing an array of new artificial intelligence and robotics capabilities into its warehouse operations that will reduce delivery times and help identify inventory more quickly. All stuff we would like, faster stuff, and knowing if it's in stock or not. So part of supply chain innovation, and yeah. The revamp will change the way Amazon moves products through its fulfillment centers with new AI-equipped sortation machines and robotic arms. It's also set to alter how many of the company's vast army of workers do their jobs. So the impact of technology on business and on people. Amazon says its new robotic system named Sequoia, is designed for both speed and safety. Humans are meant to work alongside the new machines in a way that should reduce injuries. Sequoia enables the company to put items up for sale on its website faster and be able to more easily predict delivery estimates. The new program reduces the time it takes to fulfill an order by up to 25%. More orders out quicker. And it can identify and store inventory up to 75% faster than human beings can. I don't know if this click's going to work for us in the classroom. Let me see what comes up here. Oh, I don't think there was any sound with this, but here's their robotic system. Sorting, finding stuff in bins, sorting bins around, shoving them along the line, moving them down, so people don't have to. So it's a quick, efficient system. There it is, finding it, putting it in a cart, moving it down, shoving it over to the system. And you know, if you work in a warehouse and you have to reach up high and pull that stuff off, it can be bad for you. The faster we can process inventory, the greater probability that we're going to be able to deliver it when we said we could. Amazon expects the new system to make a significant portion of the company's operations in the next 3 to 5 years, and executives see a connection between their delivery speed and growth. So innovation in the supply chain, and obviously a relationship between people being happy and growth of the company. In the new structure, vehicles transport products inside tote containers, we just saw that, to a new sortation machine equipped with small robotic arms and computer vision. From the sortation machine, the bins are routed to an employee who picks items for delivery. Remaining inventory is consolidated by Sparrow, a robotic arm Amazon revealed last year. Previously, employees might have to reach high up on a shelf to pick up a heavy item, but now the new system delivers containers around waist level. The goal is to reduce injury. So yay, tech and business. In 2022, Amazon had announced a $1 billion fund for innovation in logistics and supply chain, which is what we were talking about. So stay tuned for more changes to come. Finally, in the really exciting, area that we're talking about, managing reusable containers with sensor-driven asset intelligence. So you're responsible for those blue bins that we just saw, but your blue bins pack up and go all over the world. And you don't have 10 or 20 of those suckers. You have 10,000. 100,000, a million of those travel all around. Where are they? Where are they used? Where are they sitting? Where are they broken? Where do they need repair? How can you get to them? How are you doing that? So, a growing awareness of the environmental harm caused by global supply chains is causing many companies to step up their reliance on reusable packaging for the transport of goods. But managing and keeping tabs on those packaging units, those assets, can be a huge challenge. Theft and poor utilization pose challenges in managing reusable packaging, particularly in industries such as food, automotive, and chemicals. For example, the U.S. baking sector alone spends over $10 million annually on replacing stolen plastic trays. I bet it's the Gen Zers. They don't care about luxury. They don't care about stealing plastic trays. And 10 to 15% of reusable transport items are lost or become unusable, contributing to the replacement costs. And a leading packaging supplier manages over 350 million reusable packaging containers globally, facing a significant industry loss rate of around 10% a year. So costs in the supply chain, and of course, who ends up paying for those costs over time? Consumers. Roambee helps suppliers address losses and lack of packing container visibility by partially automating rental operations using GPS sensors on selected assets, integrating order information with visibility data, so technology and supply chain management. So here's a link to RoamB if your system could use this sort of tracking. So better real-time supply chain, better visibility and intelligence for shipping containers. Here they can help you out. RoamB's platform uses artificial intelligence and machine learning to predict the presence or absence of entire groups of reusable packing containers, providing insights into utilization, security, condition, so AI in the supply chain. Their solution helps suppliers transition from costly manual operations to a predictive asset routing model, improving work culture, team productivity, and the quality of life for field asset management professionals. RoamB's innovation earned that supplier the recognition for the 2023 Supply Chain Innovation Award. Nothing. So they're providing B2B value. So there's a lot of excitement over there in that area of the P of the marketing mix place, including supply chain, distribution, and logistics. So on the lecture notes, page 220, chapter 14, 427 of the textbook, and picking up where we left off, we were talking about this idea of thinking about the channel of distribution and how intense we needed to have our distribution. And we went through a couple examples here, and I ran out of steam, out of breath, out of time. But for convenience goods, we thought about this previously when we talked about products. We want distribution through every reasonable outlet in a market. So we have to have intensive distribution. Oh, yeah. So at first, how many of you guys like Häagen-Dazs? You know Häagen-Dazs? You like it? Häagen-Dazs are pretty good ice cream. They came up with this great idea. This was going to sort of be a luxury ice cream, as it were. It was going to be special. And you were going to order Häagen-Dazs ice cream only at Häagen-Dazs stores. It's good ice cream, but when you go out grocery shopping, do you want to do all your grocery shopping and then head to a Häagen-Dazs store? Really, people? So they initially were only available at gourmet shops in New York City and say, you know what? We're special, but we're not that special. People aren't really willing to travel just to our store to get our ice cream. They changed their channel of distribution. Anybody know Iams dog food? Yeah, no? Iams, for years, was exclusively distributed through pet stores, pet supply stores, and vet clinics, and indeed had the same problem. They moved over to be also available in grocery stores, more towards intensive distribution. They moved from number 5 to number 1 in annual sales because people could find them. People could get the product. It was available where and when they wanted it. So this is a pretty important factor in your marketing mix, how you make this stuff available. Luxottica, we chatted about them last time, has 6,400 retail outlets in the United States, Canada, China, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. The headquarters of the retail division is in Mason, Ohio. Their retail banners include Sunglass Huts International, Lens Crafters, OPSM, Lobman & Pink, Budget Eyewear, Pearl Opticians, Pearl Vision, Surf Glasses, Sears Optical, Target Optical, Kmart Optical, Cole Vision Care, Icon, and iLore. They also own iMed Vision Care, one of the leading managed vision care organizations in the U.S. You can see that their distribution of their eyeglasses is pretty intensive. Selective distribution. We talk about those as not convenience goods, but as shopping goods. We want distribution through multiple, but not all reasonable outlets in a market. So, for example, do you know Step 2? Do you guys know the company Step 2? Anybody know what they sell? What do they sell? A little louder? Little kids' toys, right? So they sell those red and orange, you know, carts that kids ride around. You don't find those everywhere, though. You find those in a select number of stores, and they're special enough that people like the product. They do seek them out. And so they're good doing selective distribution. I forget what my other example is, so we'll go with that. Why? Well, this can strengthen consumer service if it's needed, because it's not out everywhere. You have a little relationship with these select members of your channel of distribution. It can improve quality control, and you can maintain some legal influence over the price that's being offered. exclusive distribution. This is what we do for specialty products. And these are things that we've talked about before. People are willing to go wherever it's necessary to find the product. If you want a Lamborghini, you're going to find a few places in Ohio. But you're not going to find one in Kent and one in Stowe and one in Akron. So here's our Lamborghini, and those are pretty cars. Oh, and the way where I'm going to go to find it is Dublin, Ohio. It's not all over the place, folks. People are willing to track it down. What's this one? Maserati. Apparently you can find Maseratis at more places than I would expect. How many places can you find a Maserati at? Well, again, there's not one in Kent and in Stowe and in Akron and in Cleveland. There's more there than I thought. Bijan. Does anybody know Bijan? Have we talked about Bijan before? Fashion people? You don't know Bijan? So Bijan is a men's haberdashery where you can buy fancy clothes. It's on Rodeo Drive. He has like two stores in the States, or maybe three. To shop at his store, you must have an appointment. I have several pictures of me outside the store, none inside the store, because I don't have an appointment. And that's, if you can see that image of, that's his lobby in one of his stores. So it's very, very high end, and people are willing to travel from all over the world to shop men's clothing at a Bijan haberdashery. So he's an exclusive distribution for this product category. In the example of the cars, we can see where we need to have special installations, special repair services for our Lamborghini, for our Maserati. And we don't want this trying to be done all over the place in Kent, Stowe, Akron, Ravenna. We want to have some relationship with a few number of people who are special. So that's why that makes sense for them. This is just a restatement of what we've talked about. Convenience products, shopping products, specialty products. Convenient products every available place, shopping products selective distribution, specialty products limited distribution. So there we go from an image we've seen before. Everything should work smoothly. I'd love for things to happen based on our shared goals, which is what we talked about before. Let's not all fight with each other in our channel. We're trying to work together efficiently and effectively to get our product out to the consumer so everybody benefits, but life isn't that simple. There is conflict that occurs in our channel. Struggle for control of the channel does happen. So we need to understand the issues related to this conflict. And having become aware of them, find ways to control them and manage for them, or else they're just going to cause us trouble. So when does channel conflict occur? What do we mean when we talked about that? Well, it happens when one channel member, the wholesaler, sees another channel member, the retailer, to be acting in a way that prevents the first one, the wholesaler, from achieving its distribution objectives. I thought we were all working together. Why are you fighting me on this topic? Originally, for example, Home Depot, when the internet was a fresh new idea, said, you know what? This is stupid. You can't both sell your product on your website and sell your product in our store. You're competing with me. So their original response was, you know, you're in the way of my goals of selling product. Originally, then they said, you can't advertise products on your site that are sold in my store. Now, obviously, that was going to last over time. It did change over time, but Lowe's was much more open to it. They encouraged their suppliers to go online to win favor with them so that they would be more likely to put their products also in Lowe's. So channel conflict here was treated in different ways by these two places. We get horizontal conflict. This is where we get conflict between the same type of middlemen, so retail to retail, for example, Walmart versus Target, or different types of middlemen at the same level. So Hartville Hardware versus Lowe's Paint Department. Anybody been to Hartville Hardware ever? Pretty cool place. They carry a lot of stuff, and they've been there for a long time, yeah? So they've been selling your paint for 20 years, and everybody's happy. And then all of a sudden, down the street, they start selling at Target. You are not happy with that. What do you mean you're selling at Target? I'm special. We've been selling here for a long time. There's a little fussing that goes on with that sort of situation. Also, making things aggravating for channel members is what's called scrambled merchandising, where middlemen diversify into non-traditional areas. I'm an appliance company. They're getting rare to see, but I'm selling products through an appliance store. This store sells appliances. And so that's what they've been doing for a long time. They're selling my microwaves and my gas ovens and my electric ovens. And down the road is a Home Depot. Home Depot sells tools, garden supplies, lumber. All of a sudden, they start selling appliances. Again, what do you mean you're selling appliances? I sell appliances. So as middlemen diversify into what for them is a non-traditional area, here the example is Kroger's begins to offer small appliances, Target selling coffee to take away, it causes conflict with other members that used to sell those products. They get upset, causes problems in the channel. So why do we have this sort of thing going on? Well, the middleman who's made this change suddenly gets more customer traffic. Before my wife found out through my help that Dunkin' is a better tasting coffee than Starbucks, she used to be a Starbucks snob. And she would go out of her way to go to Starbucks, including running into the local Target because they had Starbucks, and while she was there, she came out with, you know, a cart full of other stuff. The consumer gets more convenience, so they're in the local drugstore and they pick up a small appliance. It was easy for them. The producer, the manufacturer, gets an expanded market from their perspective. So they're selling the product through unusual places because they get more coverage. You're still making people upset, though. Vertical conflict occurs when you have unhappiness between firms at the different level of the same channel. So this is where the retailer is upset with the wholesaler is upset with the producer in the same channel. So we can get producer versus wholesaler problems, producer versus retailer problems. This can be quite severe. People can get quite upset. For example, a while ago, Anheuser-Busch decided that their beer distributors, the people that distribute their beer throughout an air geographic area, were not carrying enough of Anheuser-Busch products. So they said, I tell you what, we need you to just carry our products. We need you to fill your inventory with our products. You need to carry exclusively Anheuser-Busch. What do you suppose a lot of beer distributors said? What are you talking about? We carry a lot of other beer. We service all these bars and restaurants. We're not just going to carry that. The 100% share of mine program did not sell well. There was conflict in that channel. So while they had financial incentives to the wholesalers to supply only the King of Beers, the wholesalers distributors said go away. So conflicts occur here because the manufacturers think, for example, that the distributors, that the wholesalers are not promoting their products aggressively enough or holding sufficient inventories in their warehouses. And so they become, in some cases, not cooperating partners, but aggressive partners. We sort of thought about this at the beginning of this little part of the conversation. A major conflict occurs when producers decide to bypass a channel member and sell directly to the consumer, bypassing the wholesaler or bypassing the retailer. So when we sell directly to the consumers by establishing our own distribution centers, our own websites, clearly we're going to accept channel members beneath us who used to sell our product for us. In the case of a wholesaler, producer selling directly to a retailer, the wholesalers are going to get upset. That's what we've been doing. Anybody know Coleman? What's Coleman sell? Camping equipment, outdoor equipment, okay? And for a long time, they sold their products through retailers. Then one day, they got the great idea of setting up their own distribution center. That's going to piss your retailers off. Again, what are you doing? This is what I do. So what they decided to do, as they sold their products directly to consumers through factory outlet stores, was to reduce, thinking ahead, dealer dissatisfaction, their retailer dissatisfaction, at least somewhat, by selling mostly reconditioned merchandise, returned merchandise, and excess inventory, instead of competing head-on-head with the newly released camping gear. So they got direct contact with the consumer on the one hand. They didn't alienate all of their retailers on the other hand. So they were trying to reduce some of that channel conflict by managing it. Goodyear messed up pretty good a while ago. For a long time, the only place you could buy a Goodyear tire was, duh, at a Goodyear store, yeah? And then one day they decided what they would do is sell directly to retailers to increase their market presence through places like Sears. Suddenly, their Goodyear distributors moved from authorized resellers to antagonized resellers. I'm here. I'm selling your product. Sears is right there. What do you mean you're selling the product through Sears? What are you doing? So Goodyear's conflicts with its independent dealers did cause hard feelings, and it actually flattened their replacement tire sales as these folks were dissatisfied. It didn't work as planned. So how do you avoid being bypassed if you're a wholesaler? How do you avoid having your producer, your manufacturer, bypass you? Well, one thing you can do is offer the other channel member, in this case the retailer, offer them something that producer, manufacturer can't offer. Come up with a unique system to offer up efficient operations, order handling, inventory control. You're going to use AI and tracking systems to follow the inventory around, let the retailer know where they stand, when they're short, what categories they're short in, how much to order in advance, when to order, and when to get it delivered. Producer's not doing that for you. Provide management assistance to their retailers. Have a good understanding of flow through the store, store layout, merchandise selecting, promotions, inventory control. So if the producer says, hey, I'm going to sell directly to you, retailer, and you say, well, are you going to offer me up improved efficient operations, order handling, inventory control, store layout, merchandise selection, promotions, and inventory control? The producer says, I don't do that. And you say, I tell you what, I'll just stay buying through the wholesaler, thank you. The elimination of intermediaries is called disintermediation. It's also referred to as cutting out the middleman. And as you can see, disintermediation does cause problems, creates channel conflict. And we need to be aware of this whole problem. I went back to this issue of you sell stuff off your website that you're also selling through a retailer like Home Depot. Black & Decker chose to avoid disintermediation upfront, early on, by not using the internet to sell their products directly to consumers. Instead, they advertise their products here and then direct consumers to other retailer websites, other physical stores that carries the firm product. Now let's see if this still is active, still works, and if they're still sending consumers, haven't looked here in a while. Thank you. I'm just curious if it's going to send me to a store to buy it. So they're giving me info, giving me info, giving me info. They're not selling me product. So I'll be with you a sec. I'm just browsing here for a little shopping. Ah, so it looks like things have changed over time. It looks like here I am able to buy directly from Black & Decker. But early on, they chase you off to the stores. We haven't heard from Gary Trinetti in a long time. Gary and his partner, both graduates of KSU, set up a corporation called Garrick, which markets a variety of lawn care products, composting, topsoil, mulch, turf, stone, aggregate for home and recreation areas. And they have a sense of humor here. One of their cow manure products is called Mooner. And he mulls over this idea of the importance of channels and distribution and how it ties in with other strategies that the company has to think about, including things like pricing, interestingly. Let's hear what he has to say.
Interesting enough, you ask about pricing. We are currently going through what they call line reviews. And the line reviews with Walmart, Home Depot, and Lowe's is basically, what is your price going to be for next season when we start? And what they've done a very good job of trying to accelerate your season, so you're still in the middle of your season for the year before, and they want to get your pricing out for next season. Well, in this era of unpredictability, you know, what's the cost of fuel going to be in 3-4 months? What is the, how many trucks are going to be available or out of business? I mean, it's very difficult right now to figure out what your price is going to be. So for the first time, we're going to tie it into a fuel surcharge, which says that if fuel prices go way, way up, then our pricing is going to follow that. Obviously, the retailers don't like that because they have a difficult time planning in times of uncertainty. But also, what's interesting is when people think of pricing, a lot of times they don't think of pricing as marketing. And, you know, I know there were 4 P's, there could be 5 or 25 P's, but it was product, place, price, and promotion. And price was an area where everybody said, well, that's the easy part. You know, you just kind of like figure out where your costs are and then add 20 or 30 or 40%. But there's so many other things that come into consideration with pricing. Are these products going to be looked at as a loss leader for your retailers? Is this product going to be used as a discounted product as a promotion? Is the price going to be, 2 for 1? So there's so many different things that you can look at, and it really, really is a function of marketing. You know, in the end, you go back to your supply chain group and you say, let's look at our costs. What's our cost going to be to get this product in a bag or in bulk or whatever it is to the marketplace to be able to price this product or have this product priced appropriately for your customer? But then now you've got to think about, what's our strategy? Do we want to get this product into every single store in the United States right now, and we need to do it quickly, so we're going to have to price it appropriately, very competitively? Do we have an advantage in the marketplace? Is this product so innovative that we're going to have this window of a year or 2 years or 6 months to price it out very, very high to realize a great profit margin on it, and we realize that our pricing will come down once our competitors catch on? Or how the customer look at this and say, how do we want to position this product in the marketplace? So it's very much a function of marketing.
So I'm not too sure when we thought about setting our price that we saw a direct relationship to a channel of distribution, but we say, hey, understanding, satisfying consumer needs, wants, and desires at a profit through an integrated effort of the firm, if our goal is to get out fast distribution intensively, we can't have prestige pricing. Those things don't tie together. Got to have low pricing to fulfill the way we want the product out there in our channel distribution. So they are integrated. They do have to work together. And you have to think of both what that retail customer wants, 2-for-1 deal, then you have to work on them with pricing, and what your goal is. Part of this whole thing of channel relationship, getting the product out, is the physical movement of product. This is called logistics. And of course, we're going to get it into supply chain manager again. Involves those activities that focus on getting the right amount of the right products to the right place at the right time at the lowest possible cost. Within this, then, logistics management is the practice of organizing the cost-effective flow of raw materials, in-process inventory, finished goods, related information from the point of origin to the point of consumption by that consumer in order to satisfy their requirements. So a supply chain is the sequence of firms that perform the activities required to create and deliver a good or service to consumers or to industrial users. It includes suppliers that provide the raw materials, the manufacturer and wholesaler and retailer that deliver the finished goods, all things we've been talking about. Now we go back to Gary and we have him think about supply chain management. And he just worked for us a minute ago and now this slide doesn't want to work. So we're back to him having us talk about supply chain management.
Well, first of all, when you talk about supply chain, you'll hear about the terminology. When I was at Kent, we never heard about supply chain management. We heard about procurement. We heard about logistics. And if you look at supply chain, for example, if you look at Home Depot or Walmart, they sell stuff. And some of them cross over a little bit into manufacturing or processing of products, but very little. If you look at it, their business is retail. And behind that retail, to get that product to the point that it's sitting on the shelf or sitting in that store, just think about all the things that have to go on behind that, behind the scenes, if you will, to get that product to the store. You know, the simple, easy one to think about is, you know, a truck. A truck's got to deliver to the store. But when you start to look at it and you kind of peel, if you will, peel away the onion, layer upon layer, if you look at those products, they're made from different raw materials. And they're made from different types of manufacturing processes. Especially in today, in light of that we're in a global economy, a lot of these products that are being marketed and being sold in the retail establishments are coming from China, or coming from India, or coming from Vietnam, or coming from Thailand, or coming from Europe, or coming from countries that, you know, maybe 10 years ago weren't even considered in part of the supply chain, if you will. So the opportunity for managing the purchasing, the procurement, the raw materials, all the way from, you know, forest products and mining or whatever, the opportunity to manage every single iteration, every single movement, every single process, if you will, a process, formulations and what have you, is there's a tremendous opportunity for that supply chain from the time that it was, you know, grown to the time it was harvested, to the time it was manufactured, all the way to the point of sale. There's a great opportunity for efficiencies, for profitability, for companies to be formed around helping facilitate all that. And one of the best supply chain companies in the world has been Walmart. And if you look at really their expertise, a lot of it has come around distribution and transportation. And they're one of, if not the largest right now, I think, logistics or trucking company in the United States right now, the Walmart trucking company, if you will. So again, supply chain is a lot more today. It crosses all the way over from growing and harvesting and manufacturing and processing and airplanes and
and barges, trucks, rails, getting the item on the shelf. So I don't know if you typically think about that, but you're a manufacturer and you have a variety of supply chain folks in front of you, component parts, raw materials. Every time there are inefficiencies there, what's it, their inefficiency going to do to your price? Your cost, rather. Their inefficiencies due to your cost? It's going to drive them up. And the higher your costs are, either the less profit you're making, or the higher your profits in the channel have to be. You surely want to have relationships with those people up the supply chain in order to partner with them and make sure that they don't have these inefficiencies that are cutting into your profit or causing you to lose business because you're more expensive than some other supply chain. I don't know if we always think about that. This leads us to the idea of supply chain management. The integration and the organization of information and logistic activities across firms, not just within your own organization, in a supply chain for the purpose of creating and delivering goods and services that provide value to customers. So this is the idea of thinking about what's happening before you in terms of your suppliers, in terms of the raw material, and down from you in terms of the wholesalers out to the retailers. So supply chain management does require the application of information technology to allow companies to share and or operate systems for order processing, transportation scheduling, inventory and facility management. If your suppliers, your component part suppliers, have no idea you've accepted a big order and you're going to need a massive influx of bolts and nuts to do whatever you're doing, they aren't ready for it, you haven't talked to them, and now here you are ready to do it and you don't have enough stuff and they don't have enough stuff, what's happening? You're not delivering when you promised because things don't exist. How about you work with them on this ordering, on this inventory? Supply chain management doesn't replace what you've learned about marketing management, about other management. Rather, it builds on best practices in a different form of management, working with other firms. So a chain, supply chain, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. You have to be sure, of course, you're not the weakest link. You aren't the person with the inefficiencies. You aren't the person not without the information supply data, and make sure that everybody else in your firm is, in your chain, is working well too. So before attempting to worry about supply chain issues, you got to be sure that you aren't the problem, that you are able to deliver the quality, and I could say quantity, of products or services that your chain expects, that you're able to do so when you're supposed to do it in a timely manner, and you aren't the problem driving up costs for the channel in a cost-efficient manner. After you're not the weakest link, you can start worrying about other channel members. Supply chain management usually requires significant changes in a firm's organizational structure, because you aren't just talking about managing your own divisions, your own people, your own locations. It's going to cut across functional areas and across to other firms as you try to manage these things. So the responsibility and authority for implementing supply chain management has to be done from the highest levels of the organization. You can't just say to your purchasing agent or your production guy, go manage the supply chain. That's stupid. Won't work. Supply chain management requires firms to put in place information systems and measures that focus on the performance across the entire supply chain. I know what I'm doing here in my Kent plant. Everything's good in my Kent plant. I got focus on that. Well, that's all fine and good, but if you don't have measures across the entire supply chain, you're going to miss other units that are trying to maximize their performance without regard to what it means for the whole supply chain. You have to have standards in place, metrics in place, measures in place, information flow in place to make sure that you're able to manage the whole thing. If you don't, if some channel member is acting in their own best interest without consideration of everybody else, it's going to cause problems for everybody. Stuff isn't where it needs to be, when it needs to be, in the amount it needs to be in, and the quality needs to be in, at the price it needs to be in. And you should have caught that, because they're part of your supply chain. Supply chain management means that you not only need to do better than your competition to succeed, but you've got to be better with your multiple firm supply chain than their multiple firm supply chain is. We thought we were just worried about fighting off competition at our level. No. So you need to not only work better among the functional areas of your own firm, but think about how you're partnering with those other firms, your components providers, their raw material providers, your distribution people, to succeed against other long supply chains. For the visual learners, here we have some stuff going on in a supply chain. On our left-hand side, we have raw materials. I don't know what those things are in our example. It's metal and forest products, and it's all going out there, and it's going in to build component pieces and parts, and those people eventually put stuff into more components and parts, and eventually it comes over to us, to our production enterprise, where we have to do marketing and sourcing and operations and logistics, and we got to get this stuff shipped out to our distribution network, through our wholesalers, through our distributors, through our agents, and eventually out to our retailers and to our end consumers. So now let's overlay this into a example that's a little more specific. Let's relate logistics management, supply chain management to supplier networks and marketing channels. So here we have the left-hand side, our suppliers, those guys out there. And we have to have a flow of raw materials and parts, pieces over to the producer. And that flow of material, I know what that first thing is, an ore cart, truck, shipping package to a factory. That's part of logistics management, the flow of stuff. Once we've made it, we also have to manage the outbound flow of our finished products from our plant to another truck, to another site, out to the consumer. That flow of product is part of logistics management. But the relationship among these guys, the network of suppliers to the manufacturer, to the network of distributors, the marketing channel, is where we talk about supply chain management. It's not just the flow of goods, it's that whole set of relationships to make sure things are flowing efficiently and effectively. No longer long enough to have good relationships with individual suppliers. We need to communicate with an entire network of suppliers who in turn need to coordinate their activities to our related firm. I thought it was hard enough just to work with the people in my department. So, out here on the left-hand side, we see some details for a hypothetical car situation. What are the raw materials? Well, steel and aluminum and rubber, and I'm sure a bunch of other things. Those all have to work among themselves to be ready to be delivered and turned into components like transmissions and brakes and seats and, depending on our company, batteries. Those go into a sub-assembly, more supplier networks, suspensions and chassis and engines. Finally, we get that stuff out to our plants and we put it all together as a General Motors, Ford, or Toyota car. Having done that, we now have to get it distributed out to our dealers. And having done that, we hope it eventually gets out to the consumer. A lot of stuff going on there to make that happen. Hopefully, we're managing our supply chain well. Now, we do have to think about this in terms of marketing, and we have to see some issues that could go on there. So in real life, our supply chain team may focus on their short-term operation results. We should be catching that, but it can happen. If they focus on short-term costs and that focus on short-term costs doesn't produce the inventory that we need, we aren't going to get the positive profit results that we set this whole supply chain up to help us with. So, for example, let's take a look at some examples of objectives that we might have for our organization. So I think we'd all agree, would we not, that one of the objectives we should have is to satisfy customer needs. Okay, I'm with you so far. But we're an operation, we're an organization, we're a manufacturer. So we also have to pay some attention to efficiencies within our organization. We can't be wasteful. Things have to work efficiently. And by the way, I don't pay much attention to that in the marketing side of the house, but I have a whole physical plant, I have a whole set of assets, I have a whole set of people out there. They have to be managed effectively too. So the customer needs, which from our perspective ought to be the focus of our marketing efforts, and the firm might find themselves in some kind of conflict with the efficiencies, an important cost-related focus to reduce our transportation costs, our inventory costs, and our production costs. I hope we're doing it in alignment with our customer needs, but who knows what they're doing over there. And assets are expensive. So asset utilization is the idea of getting the most out of our production facilities, the most out of our capital investments, out of our plant, out of our equipment, out of our people. All that's expensive. So here we are focusing on the customer, and we got to know what's going on in these other areas as they focus on efficiencies, asset utilization. So our supply chain thinks about the situation, and they say, well, look, to be efficient, we're going to have the lowest procurement costs possible. Okay. We're going to have the highest plant utilization we can get. Seems efficient to me. and we're going to carry the least amount of inventories. Can you see how that logic might play out for people in the plant? Our customer, though, wants high quality products. They want innovation, and they want a broad product line. As you mull over those two positions, can you see that you're going to have a bit of a disconnect? Can you imagine a situation where you can get high quality products by buying the lowest possible pieces and parts? Can you imagine a place where you're going to be able to get innovation and a broad product line while having high plant utilization? What's that mean? Long runs of the same thing and not carrying much inventory. How are you going to provide them with a broad product line? There's a conflict. There's a disconnect. These folks are not focused on what our customer needs. So what are you going to do? If your customer wants high quality innovation and a broad product line, you have to rethink what's going on. Our supply chain then has to switch its focus. They've got to switch to high supplier quality for the chain, not lowest procurement costs. They've got to switch to shortest time to market so our customer can have innovation. They've got to recognize they can't have long production runs of the same thing, which is efficient. So how are they going to have some efficiency there? Find ways to have the shortest changeover times in the plant to get more efficiencies. We've now begun to reconcile our supply chain and its efficiency needs, in quotes, with our customer wants. So we're going to close that gap. So to cure the problem, whatever your situation is, you have to understand whatever your consumer needs are, how important and what value they put on, I don't know, lead time, a quick response, efficient customer response, dependability, communication, convenience. What is it that these people value? That's going to be the place to start curing this problem with your supply chain. Understand our supply chain and its strengths and weaknesses against what these consumers' needs, wants, and desires are. And then harmonize the supply chain strengths with our marketing strategies to satisfy that consumer with their need. Maybe we have to redesign the supply chain, which we just alluded to. Maybe we have to break the supply chain and put new players in it. I regularly refer to the need for information to make all this work. So this is touching on the idea of information's role in supply chain in causing it to be responsive and efficient. So EDIs, electronic data interchanges, combine proprietary computer and telecommunication technologies to exchange electronic invoices, payments, information among suppliers, manufacturers, and retailers. We talked previously about, in the days before the pandemic, how much paper there still was in the supply chain. People were writing invoices out by hand. They're physically driving them somewhere or mailing them somewhere. People are doing stuff with them and then physically taking them somewhere else or mailing them somewhere else. How long is that going to take? Beep, done. Beep, shared here. You want it done electronically. You got to make that changeover. Again, I always ask and no one answers. IS people, CIS people. Yeah. All right. Apparently we need more of you because you're going to help us make this work on the back end, behind the scenes. Easy to say, but think about what it means to talk about this flow of information. So we're in here in an organization and supply chain. We're focused on the manufacturer. So in comes what's called a tender requirement. It's somebody saying, hey, I need to have this product. Can you make it to these specs? Okay, it's a request for you to supply product. So it's part of what the customer wants. Well, first of all, you have to be sure your system gets the information and shares it within your organization. People lose business because that request for information goes away. It's a piece of paper. It doesn't get filed right. All right, so this gets put into our network. We look for information from manufacturing and marketing. Can we meet these specs? We get information from our own outlets, from our suppliers, and from production. Can we meet these specs? We bid and negotiate in real big business-to-business situations, contracts, and finally we have an order from the customer. We're going to give you this amount on these dates, in this color, at this price point, no problem. We can do that. Can we do that? I don't know. Can we do that? Hopefully we're going to do that. So now we have the order. Somebody's got to do something to make that happen, so now the order has to get into the system, okay? So here comes the order flowing into the system. Boom! We got to process the order. If all is smooth, then what do? We go over to our inventory. We say, hey guys, pull this order, put it in the warehouse. Hey warehouse, put it in the transportation, ship it out to the customer. They got it. Whoops! Turns out we don't have enough of that stuff. Hopefully we shared that with the customer when we made our plans. So now what do we got to do? Well, maybe we just go up and we make the stuff. Takes a while, doesn't happen magically, so it's a work in progress. A friend of mine, before he sold out for some pretty good money, I believe, ran a optical supply house out of Cleveland. And one of the big deals, he would take orders from physicians, from opticians, eye doctors. And they would always want to know, where is this order for my customer? It's special lenses, it's special frames, it's got coatings, it's not done that day. It takes time. They had to order the frames in, they had to order the lenses, so they always wanted to know what was going on. So they always wanted to know, and they had to have bins with tags on them and tracking. Where is that work today? Not that he was a relatively small business, but imagine how that works for a really big company with lots of things going on. Where's my order? So you have work in progress you have to track. Eventually it all comes together, you get the final production process, it goes in inventory to your warehouse, out to the customer. Whoops, turns out we can't build it. Why not? Because we don't have the pieces and parts available in our inventory. Oops, wish you would have told me that before. So now we're going to go up to our suppliers. We have to go through purchasing and give our suppliers an order for pieces and parts and raw materials, etc. They have to go through the same thing. I hope the information is flowing here. They have to go into their order processing. They have to, if they have it in-house, process it and ship it out. If not, they have to get in their pieces and parts to come back so they can make it, so they can ship it to you, so you can get it, so it can go in your inventory, so you can put it into your manufacturing. Finally, stuff gets shipped from your plant out to the customer. Did they get it? Did they get it right? Any problems? Did you set up training for them? They need a lot of learning on how to make this thing work. Was the site properly prepped? Did you get information out on that? Are they using it right? Do they have maintenance over time? What about those other pieces and parts that they need to make your product work right over time? Are you have those going on? Information on that? Is it flowing? Repair issues? And eventually, over time, it has to be replaced, it has to be removed. It took me a long time to say that, but imagine for a large organization with many, many products and many customers coming in, how important that flow of that information is to making this whole thing work. It breaks down somewhere and you have what we had in the pandemic. Things don't get where they need to be. That's what it looks like overall. We need information in a customer-driven supply chain. Now, not only do we need information to manage the supply chain, but we also need it to help us balance the total cost of our logistics efforts with the value that we provide to our customers. Not 100% exactly this, but you remember back to when we saw McDonald's going into China, and they woke up one day, and you would think they're McDonald's, they would know this, and they said, we learned we shouldn't open just one store and ship products from our warehouses to one store in a truck. Here's this big mother truck, it's got, 22 packages of buns, and you ship it off to one store. They said, we learned you should open up three or four stores at a time. load that truck up and drive the truck out full of product. How about balancing your situation so you're balancing the total cost of your logistic efforts with the value, well, in this case, they were providing themselves, but to their customers. Here's a situation of a major player, Eaton. Anybody know the brand or the company Eaton? Out of Cleveland, Fortune 500 company, where they're talking to their distributors. Let's see if my site is still up and working. Things go away. Where they were talking to the distributors about the tools that they had available to their distributors under their e-commerce umbrella. Order Central was Eaton's global digital solution for your e-commerce needs. VistaLine on the web, multifunctional e-business system that creates a point-and-click interface to place order entry in a B2B world. This is not out to ultimate consumers, but to their distributors. So, if this sounded at all interesting, I probably didn't do it justice. We do have a course, 44062, Supply Chain Management. It's going to help us see how all this stuff works together, supplier, manufacturing, distribution, retail, and up to the consumer. Another part of this P of the marketing mix that we'd be that we wouldn't want to forget about is retailing and a bit of wholesaling. So chapter 16, so in our channel, producer, wholesaler, retailer, consumer, we're now focusing on the wholesaler and retailer side of things. Recapping where we are, product, service, price, place, and soon promotion with the customer at the center. So let's backtrack one more time over our friend, the pandemic, and see what it's done or did to our friend, the retailer. The pandemic rewrote the rules of retail. Retailers may need to stop expecting business to return to normal. There's no going back to how it was anytime soon. Research suggests that consumers are likely to keep the behaviors they've adopted amid stay-at-home orders, such as more online shopping and fewer mall visits. Now, I will say, my wife, who does get out of the house for us and goes to places like the mall, there's people there. It's not like nobody's there. All malls haven't closed. But there's still a boatload more people ordering online than there were before the pandemic. They got into the habit of that. However, retailers need to reimagine their baseline requirements, turn their attention to taking their customer experience to the next level to keep those customers engaged. Retailers have to adapt their bricks and mortar operations to meet customers' new expectations. This includes improving the speed of service, introducing more self-service options. Retailers also need to offer a simple, seamless e-commerce experience from browsing to researching, selecting, purchasing, returning, and exchanging goods. Subpar digital shopping will no longer be acceptable to consumers. They've gotten used to the best of the best over the pandemic. We have to rethink our in-person experiences. Recently, retailers have been putting as much, if not more, priority on the in-store experience than on the products that they sell. As a result of the pandemic, all retailers had to make their in-store experiences even more extraordinary for those who could visit. They have to give people a reason to visit that's so compelling it justifies overcoming that inertia of the behaviors that we created during the shutdown. Offer an exclusive superior service like luxury cinemas once did. Elevate in-person customer service. Best Buy's free in-home consultation services. How many of you guys have been to a movie theater recently that does have the reclining seats? That's pretty comfy. Let you order from a menu and have it delivered to your reclining seat, right? No? Yeah? That's pretty cool. I couldn't quite figure out how that would work, but they knew who I was, and I scanned it, and they brought it over. Does your grandma think about that? What are you talking about, reclining seats at the movie theater? We've changed the way we've done this stuff to draw people into these experiences. Digitally native customer experience. Many retailers Retailers with roots in bricks and mortar simply try to replicate their in-store experience online, but that's not going to work. Consumers don't expect a virtual experience to be like an in-person one, and they don't want it to be. So you got to invest some time in the unique capabilities of digital. Have real-time inventory management, predictive analytics, AI-powered search, and personalization and co-created functions. I forget where I was looking the other day online, and I finally just gave up. Because it wouldn't, the search was stupid. If I put in, I don't know what I was putting in. I'm trying to think of something that's, if I put in honey-flavored cough drops, you ought to be able to take me to wherever you do or don't have honey-flavored cough drops. How many clicks do you want me to do to look for that? I'm done. I'm going somewhere else. What were you thinking? Social commerce, which enables companies to sell through social media channels, and also incorporates social interactions, peer support, reviews, recommendations, multimedia content, personalization, gamification, and more. These folks want something exciting when they get to your website. So let's jump back one cycle, back to before the pandemic, and hear a little bit about eBay and what they were doing with their marketplaces idea.
I should say the death of the store has been greatly exaggerated. There'll be a transformation of retail real estate, but not an end to it. You could step back and connect dots and say the world's going to have e-commerce only and that stores are dead, but we don't see that future at all, in part because I don't think consumers want that future. I think people like to shop and they like the serendipity of stores. And shopping is as much about entertainment and engagement as it is about utility. I think stores are going to become as much distribution and fulfillment centers as they are full-fledged shopping experiences. I think that stores and malls are going to be highly technology enabled. Think of today, the square footage in a store needs to attract people in the door. It needs to have the right inventory at the right time, and it needs to have high service levels. That's a very expensive model, and it's a very inefficient model. What e-commerce has shown is that, particularly down the tail, it's much better business model to be just in time. And I think that there's a pattern in there for the way stores will transform. They'll become technology enabled so that you can go to a store and see enough inventory, but you may shop shoppable windows. We're building those right now for retailers around the world. So I think that there are going to be stores, and I think that retail real estate is not dead, but it is going to transform, and it's going to happen faster than people think.
And of course, the pandemic moved that that change in consumer attitudes around a little bit. This is another element of eBay and their innovation lab.
This is our innovation lab. We call it the Batcave. We're over here in Campbell. Really, we needed some space to do things like build big fitting rooms and have large displays, and there wasn't a lot of room on campus to do that.
And if you can tell by this space, I mean, it's always an evolution.
Our relationship with Rebecca Minkoff actually started last year. We did a digital storefronts project at the Westfield in San Francisco.
And in partnering with eBay, we were able to actually have a wish list and work with them to create really what we thought would be pushing the boundaries between fashion and technology.
And it's really about being able to bring in this concept of mobile and physical and e-com and retail all together in this one moment.
It's incredibly complicated to make a simple experience. We've labored for months making sure that when you walk into this tech, it just speaks to you. It's beautiful, it's seamless, it's integrated, and you know how to use it.
Multiple experiences basically fuel the next endeavor or next experience, and to leverage that and harness it, that's really powerful. Not a lot of organizations can do that.
Powering experiences with technology in a retail space in the offline world will definitely have people thinking of eBay differently.
After months and months of crazy customer research and a bunch of testing in our lab in Campbell, now to have it live in New York City and seeing customers delighted by this is a true testament to how far the technology's come and how amazing this partnership truly is.
They went above and beyond to make this happen, so I feel incredibly indebted to the eBay team, because without them, this would just be, you know, oh, that's a good idea.
By bringing this technology into retail space is literally the implementation of us participating in all commerce. It's no longer blurring the line. We are doing it.
I think upon seeing the reaction from people, it really made it clear that, oh, this is the future of retail. This is the future of shopping.
That's incredibly engaging and energizing to wake up every morning and have that as your mission.
To be able to move retail forward with probably its biggest single advance in years is just, you can't describe what that feels like.
This is just a starting point. You have so many more ideas. Over the course of this next year, I just can't wait to see what the future has in store.
I don't have to have all of the product inventory in the store the way I used to. I can have a few items. People can walk up to this screen. They can see what they have on looks like. They can push what about in green, what about in yellow, what about in blue, what about in slim line. What if I'm outside? Boom, I'm outside. Can do all that stuff. What if I want a handbag? What if I want a purse? Or I don't know what I'm saying. What if I want some other sorts of stuff? And on the screen, you can move around and see stuff as though you were wearing it. It's exciting, it's interesting, it's involving, and you don't have to carry as much product physically in the store. And it's happening, of course, right now with Rebecca Minkoff. Okay, I'm tired. Go home. Have a good weekend. See you on Monday.